Log Talk Radio.
Ding, 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 ding. Hello, everybody. Jay?
Hello, everybody.
So we've now both said hello to everybody.
Dave, you're back in New York. It's good to see you.
I am. You know, it's walking over here is like my poor thermostat doesn't know where it is.
Right.
Temperatures are all over the map. You know, on the way over, it was like there were most of the way it was like in the 30s, some places even in the 20s.
But now you're finally here. It's like you're not in transition anymore, correct?
I know. Yeah. Well, that's true. Actually, I'm now a New Yorker. I went back to California to put my house on the market, and it was a harrowing week. I mean, it was just dealing with 30-plus years' worth of possessions. This was the move where I finally, you know, shed almost everything and only kept... I followed the advice of Bruce Sterling, who I heard speak at the Reboot Conference in Copenhagen last year. And he gave some advice about how to, you know, when it's time for you to do the big move, this is how you ought to approach things, you know, in terms of what you keep and what you throw out. So I threw out a ton of stuff, gave a ton of stuff away, and I sold the house, or I'm selling the house, knock wood, we hope, and moved into a one-bedroom apartment. I still will have a storage unit in California, but a very, very small one. And so... It's good. I want to go lighter.
Lighter, yeah. Lighter. That's what I was going to say. Now you're lighter.
Yeah. Well, physically, I'm just about the same weight, unfortunately.
Yeah, but now that you're lighter, you can soar.
We hope. Yeah.
You said you had a surprise for us?
I do have a surprise for you. And I'm going to ask Adrian to bring you the surprise now. Okay. And while he's doing that, I'll explain why I'm doing this and what I'm doing. I listened to a podcast on the way out. I listened to a lot of podcasts on the trip.
Mm-hmm.
I used it as an opportunity to get caught up on a lot of things. And one of the podcasts I listened to was
Slate.
Oh, yeah, see, there's this. That was a surprise.
You're
that,
giving me an
No, I'm not giving it to you. Of course I'm not giving it to you, although it may feel that way. No, we're going to have what this segment is called iPad First User Experience.
Oh,
yeah, and
I get
so,
it. Yeah.
Right, and so what I heard was Slate did this. They did an unboxing on the air, and as I heard them describe what they were going to do,
right,
I realized that it was going to blow up in their faces because the unboxing of the iPad
is
horribly anticlimactic. Basically, you boot the thing up and it says, "Find me an iTunes." That's all it can do. It's completely impotent on its own. So and so they just spent a half hour bitching and moaning about how this thing just wants iTunes because they didn't have an iTunes.
Great radio.
To give it to. No, it was really poor radio because it was nice to hear somebody finally, you know, say the emperor has no clothes because I was horribly disappointed when I saw that, when that was the first thing it said to me. It never occurred to me that a product like this, so momentous and earth-shaking, could possibly say something so stupid
right.
The first moment you use it. So this thing's already been iTunes-ized,
yeah.
And I just threw it in your hands, and I said, okay, now you tell us about it. Tell us about it.
Well, how do I turn it on?
Okay. Well, why don't you see? Come on. I'm not.
All right.
I don't want to tell you that.
All right, I just figured that out.
Did you?
Ooh, nice.
Say what you did, though.
I pressed the button on the bottom center.
Okay, good.
And it says slide to unlock, and now everything just disappeared.
Uh-oh.
I think I better press it again. Okay.
Maybe we better send it tech support in there with Adrian. Adrian, do you want to go
All right, now I see.
Oh, he seems to have
I got it back
out.
Up.
He seems to figure
now
it
out. Now I see. Wait a minute, it just went off again.
You don't have an iPhone, do you, Jay?
No.
Okay, that's all right. This is supposed to be for neophytes. Everybody keeps telling us, you know, neophytes will love this. They don't need any computer experience.
I just turned it on for the third time, and it went off for the third time.
Why did it go off? Now you better go watch. Okay, this is very...
Live radio.
This is like Slate again. This is the same thing. I can't imagine why it's doing that. Folks, I can't see what Jay is doing, which is actually really
good. See, I'm
really
already...
We sent Adrian
watch
in there
this.
To figure this out, what's going on. Adrian, who is an iPhone
user.
Oh,
okay.
So what was the problem, Adrian?
He had to slide and actually hold a slide.
Oh, he wasn't holding it. Okay.
All right.
Now, help him find the New York Times there. Let's have him read the New York Times. Adrian, Stay in there. Adrian didn't stay.
App Store, YouTube, Gmail.
Yeah,
Safari,
that's not going to get you the New York Times, unfortunately.
iPod, notes, contacts. I don't see the
okay.
New York Times anywhere.
Let me tell you how to do that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right? Put your finger in a dark area where there is no icon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then just flick your finger to the left. Flick it.
Ah,
now,
there
do you
go.
See the New York Times?
I see Editor's Choice. Times.
Right, that's yeah. what you're looking for. Yeah,
all
the New
right.
York Times logo. Now, okay, so now here's your journalism professor.
Right.
Okay, right.
Looking at the
tenured
New York-
journalism professor at NYU.
Nice.
Is going to read the New York Times on the iPad.
Okay. And I see a list of headlines and stories. Looks very good. Well, this is a pleasant experience. I see an article that I opened up, which certainly looks attractive. I don't see any links in it, however.
No links. There are no links.
Uh-huh. And I'm flipping through the article. And how do I go back to where I was?
That was hard for me, too. It took me a while to figure that one out.
No. Oh, okay.
It should be in the upper left corner of the screen. There's a button that takes you back. You can also flick. That flicking gesture is good, too.
Now I got the keyboard up. That's interesting. All right.
I wonder why.
Now I'm back at the Times app so that I can restart what I was doing. Editor's Choice News. All right. So this.
Now, if you look, Jay, if you look at the bottom of the screen, you should see a bunch of categories. Like
yes,
technology,
okay.
Business,
right. Opinion.
Features,
let me
opinion.
See that.
Yeah, opinion. That's good.
All
good
right.
Place to go.
Ross Douthat, he wrote about me recently, so I'm going to look at him. Okay. Well, I get this. How do you hold this so that it's easy to read?
That's a really good question, actually.
Because I don't really want to use one of my hands to hold this thing.
You don't really. Well, they have a stand for it. I saw a guy on. I took a plane out to California, and there was another guy on there who had an iPad, and he had it on the stand, and he was using it to watch a movie.
I can
but
see
you
why
pretty
the stand.
Much do have to use a hand if you don't have the stand.
Mm-hmm.
That rhymes.
See, I wouldn't. That would immediately flummox me there, right there.
Yeah.
The need for the hand. Okay. Well, let's see now. How do I get out of this iPad? No. How do I get out of the Times app? That's my question at the moment.
It's a good one. Well, I can give you a clue. That button at the bottom that turned it off, that's a big deal, that button.
Uh-huh.
That's sort of like your home button.
If I touch it again, it's not going to turn it off?
No, but wouldn't you think? You might think it would do that,
okay,
but it doesn't
I see.
Do that.
Okay.
That home button is also on iPhones is also, if you used an iPhone, you would know
gotcha.
That.
Gotcha. Let me open up NPR.
That's interesting.
That didn't work. NPR. Come up, NPR. Very attractive. Okay. Playlist.
This must be fascinating to the people at home listening to this.
Huh.
But it was, but it's a
all right.
legitimate use of, this is rebooting the news a little bit here, right? You're actually listening to somebody get the first-time user experience.
I tell you what I do see that is different and kind of radical is the idea of the touch as the controlling action for a computer. Then the tactile part of it is extremely different than moving symbols around.
People
and
say that, yeah.
It does change your relationship with the machine because the body is way more involved in this machine than simply the mind and the sort of the digital capacity of the human mind. And that already gives it a very different feel. So in that sense, I see it as disruptive or different, very different.
Adrian, you were saying you wanted to say something?
If I may, I just wanted to add that I do a lot of digital photography on the iPhone, and that experience indeed, you use your finger to color, to do painting.
Mm-hmm. So he hit on an important idea there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
I think that's, for me, is very different, because I feel I'm accessing a part of my mind when I'm just manipulating symbols. Mm-hmm. But it's a very different part of my mind when I'm using my body to rearrange my world. Mm-hmm. And that would change sort of cognitively my experience of the computer. But I'm sort of like you. I can't see myself using this very often at the moment. But I'll keep an open mind about it. You may find in a few months I have an iPad, or maybe early next year or something.
Yeah. Well, I was saying before you got here that when I pulled it out of my knapsack to, you know, I got into the office here and took it out. The map was on a town called Sydney, and I couldn't remember, where is Sydney? And I zoomed out several times, and I saw, oh, that's right, it's in Nebraska. So you can see that I got a lot of use. And I had, well, I mean, part of the problem is my Sprint MiFi was practically useless on the trip. You were going to ask me to talk about what I learned on the trip.
So why don't we say,
in the meantime, why don't you just keep playing with
okay.
it? Okay. The only thing I ask that you do is you not look at my email, okay?
Sure.
That would be that kind of a personal
request
there.
I read your blog while you were crossing the country, and of course I looked at your Twitter stream, and you said you had a lot of time for thinking, and you kind of cleared out a lot of things.
Yeah.
So in this time for thinking that you had as you crossed the country, which is a great tradition of writers and thinkers,
mm-hmm.
what did you discover or come upon?
You know, it's funny, because I haven't had the time since getting back to ask myself that question. You know, what happens when you get back is immediately you're mired in all the details that you left behind.
True.
And for me, it was kind of an accomplishment to actually make it through New Jersey and across the Lincoln Tunnel and show up at my apartment and not get a ticket parked out front and move everything upstairs and get, you know, whatever. So,
right.
You know, I have to say, the thing, it's going to maybe sound prosaic, but one of the conclusions that I came to, because, you know, the Twitter conference was happening also while I was traveling.
Right, with the developers.
So I had to, you know, and I would say that I can prove that I wasn't surprised, because I had written beforehand my sort of take on what was likely to happen, and it was more or less exactly what had happened, right down to the point where they would go into vaporware on their grand announcement, you know. And, you know, I felt and have felt actually all along that for Twitter developers, that it would be very wise for them as a group to put more focus on working with each other than trying to do the deal with a platform vendor. This is something that I learned many, many years ago when I was an Apple Macintosh developer in the early 90s and was doing system software, basically, that enhanced all the other software on the platform, and it required developers to add something to their apps. And I had been quite successful, actually, in getting a lot of them to do it, but then Apple, well, it's a long story. Everybody wanted to do deals with Apple. Nobody wanted to do deals with each other. And as a result, we all failed. Mm-hmm. Everybody failed in that whole space, including Apple. Because this was the pre-Jobs Apple. This was the interim period where he wasn't there. And there's no question that that Apple failed. And so it's not a good strategy for everybody to try to do deals with, when you have a corporate-owned platform, it's not a good idea for everybody to try to do the deal with a platform vendor. Maybe some of them actually will do the deal. And that certainly happened this week with Twitter. They bought Tweety, and they'll probably buy a few other things too. But the vast majority of Twitter developers will not get bought by Twitter. And so they have to be thinking now, well, what is my plan? How am I going to actually turn this thing, my thing, into a business? Everybody had been talking about, well, what about Twitter turning their thing into a business? Now the question is, well, what are you going to do, Mr. Mm-hmm. Developer? And anyway, so
that was one thing. And
this came back. You know, we had a talk. We talked about, you and I did a podcast just as my trip was beginning.
Right.
And you talked about how Columbia University was doing a program with between journalism and computer science. And of course, that got my wheels going. And I think that what we should do here in New York, and not just limited to New York, but everywhere, but we start here with the people we know, is that we start implementing the new system of the future, period. Stop putzing around and stop waiting for somebody else to do it, you know?
When you say implementing, what do you mean?
Well, there you go. There you go again. All right. Well, that's, of course, we know what we mean by the new implementing. Implementing means, well, what do I mean by implementing? What did Tim Berners-Lee do to when he set about to implement the web? Right? No, more or less the same thing. What you do when you're doing something like that is you create a new system of the future, right? And then you show everybody else how to do it. And you repeat the process over and over again.
I see what you mean. You start operating with the new system in any way you can.
Absolutely. Right. And you and wherever possible, you choose to not use a platform that's owned by a corporation. You create a platform that's owned by nobody.
Ah.
That's a very key component.
May I interject?
Of course.
I recently joined the advisory board of a newspaper company. First time I've ever done this. It's called the Journal Register Company, which is a bankrupt newspaper chain that has to be resuscitated. And a new CEO has come in, John Patton, who's kind of an expert in taking dead companies and doing what's necessary to bring them back to life. And the first meeting of the advisory board actually is today, later today. One of the projects he's doing to teach this company new ways of working is he's going to take one or two of the weekly newspapers that this chain owns, and they're going to produce an edition of the paper entirely with free web tools available on in the cloud or online.
There you go.
And just figure out how to do it. So that's sort of an example. It's like, let's use the tools that are out there. Let's throw away the entire system that we used to produce this weekly with, right?
Yeah.
It's not just using like cheap publishing tools that you might find online, like WordPress or something like that, but it's also using open source methods for gathering information, you know, asking readers to help you do your journalism, finding tools you can use even to do billing and the back office work of the, right? And simply by doing it, you kind of force people out of their routines, and you have to learn.
It's more or less what I say in, you know, I wrote the draft. I often do this for important talks that I'm going to do. I write them in advance. Don't memorize it, but because I don't want to do a rote speech. But so I wrote my talk for tomorrow, and I talk about that basically.
What is tomorrow? Tell our listeners.
Tomorrow is the 140 characters conference, Jeff Poehler's conference
in New York.
In New York, yeah. And I asked to talk at this here, particularly in New York, because and the timing is incredible. Because I wanted to say, you know, here I am.
Right.
Hello. You know. And this is why, and this is what's important. And so in thinking about it, so this is more sort of answering your question, what is it that the people in the news business need to hear? And I had said this actually in a talk that I gave in Switzerland 10 years ago. I was talking to leaders of the publishing industry, and I said, the way to visualize what you have to do is you're jumping out of an airplane without a parachute, and you have to find a way to fly. You have to find a way to not hit the ground so hard that it kills you, but you can no longer stay in the airplane. The airplane doesn't work anymore. And now, 10 years later, you might even say the airplane doesn't even exist, and you already are already flying without the parachute, you know, whether you even know it or not, you know. All these news organizations are somehow managing, the ones that are surviving are managing to survive without a business model. How they're doing, you know, it's like, wait, you know, pinch me. Here I am already doing it, and I was fighting it every step of the way, right? But what I say is that what we have to do in the media industry is we have to create the new system of the future, and then experience it and immerse ourselves in it long before we'll ever figure out how it makes money, because you can't even think about it until you've had the experience of using it. You can't use it until it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you must create it in order to experience it, in order to have any ideas that are worth anything. And the thing that you have to trust is you have to trust two things. One is the ultimate fairness of the universe. And now the universe.
Fairness in the universe.
Well, I know
it may or may not. Podcast.
It may or may not be fair, but you don't have a choice. You have to trust that. This is the thing that this is the deal we all made with existence when we were born, Jay.
Wait a second. Do you mean fairness or the non-arbitrariness?
I mean fairness.
Really? You think there's fairness in the universe?
Sure. Well, I don't know that there is, but
okay,
I
so
know
you have to trust the fairness of the universe.
This is a fine point. Right. I don't know that there is, but I'm trusting
trust
that it is there.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, my existence makes no sense whatsoever. If the universe is unfair, I'm like, you know, there's no point being here, but I don't even want to know because forget it.
Our existence is absurd.
Right. And the second thing that you have to depend on is the greed of the users. The users are greedy. And when you show the users something that they want, and they have to really, really want it, and almost at the lust level, they'll figure out a way for you to continue doing it. Throw the problem in their lap. But before you get to do that, you can't do it by whining and complaining. You can't do it by saying, I have to exist or else I don't exist. That's not going to get you anywhere. Nobody gives a damn, right? What you have to hit them with, and this is what Steve Jobs, of course, does so incredibly well,
right?
He has to make you feel like your existence is worthless without his latest toy, right?
Right.
Now, some people feel that way and other people don't.
Yeah, in a way, his industry is desire.
Completely. I say lust, but desire and lust are the same thing, you know? Yes, it's not technology. It's desire. And the news industry needs to be there. Now, luckily for the news industry, there are a fair number of people that do lust for their product, or else they would not even have a prayer, because they need both things. They need the fairness, and they need the lust. And so create this news system. This is what we have to do. And so one of the things, when you say, you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this, you're going to say that till forever. It'll never happen, right? What you have to do is say, this is what I have to do.
Sure.
Right?
I'm familiar with this philosophy. I've done this myself.
Right. So that's what we need to do.
Yeah. Right?
Or I need to do it. There should really be nothing else to do here, is to create that news system and then see what happens. So why don't we just do it? I plan to meet with the people in the comp sci department here at NYU.
Yeah? Cool.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to meet with the people at the comp sci department at Columbia.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I am. And anybody else that wants to talk to me about this, I want your best students. I want the ones that are, I want some grad students in comp sci that I don't want first-year grad students. I don't want only first-year grad students. I don't mind some first-year grad students, but I want some people who have taken some of the classes and have some promise, even ambition or fire in their belly or however you want to put it, that they have to have a role in the rebooting of the news. This has to be something they really, really, really are passionate about. Plus, they also have to have the skills in computer science. And from there, I don't have any doubt we can do it. We'll find the resources we need. You know, with servers in the cloud are not that expensive these days. We'll get a little bit of money. We'll get the servers up. All we need to do is build enough of a system so that we can have the experience of it. I don't mean prototypes. I don't mean concepts. I don't mean planning for what it would look like when and if we ever got it together. I mean the actual system. Why are you laughing? I hope that's because you like this.
Well, I love the idea, absolutely.
I have a track record with this stuff, Jay.
Yeah.
I've actually,
you know,
done
where
some
a place
of this stuff.
Where I would love to see you start is the idea you had a while ago called Checkbox News.
Yeah, totally. Isn't that nice?
I love that
Let's
idea.
Let's do it.
Checkbox News. What is Checkbox News?
Well,
fill the listeners in.
Okay. I got the idea for Checkbox News when I used to be a news junkie, MSNBC, CNN, that kind of thing, right? During the political campaign 2007, 2008. And I'd get tired of certain stories. They would just, like, completely dominate the news. And I'd
right.
go, nah,
like the latest poll results.
Well, that I didn't – They yeah, maybe. No, in this case, it was Boris Yeltsin's death. And mm-hmm. Although I actually found that kind of interesting for a while. There was the Virginia Tech
yeah.
stuff had really started to drone. I mean, they were starting to do all these interviews. I actually heard a thing on the media. They had this fascinating story where they did a study. Somebody did a study and listened to the actual words the grievers were using and compared them to the words that grievers in earlier outrages had used, and they were identical. These people had watched the news the first time to rehearse, to learn what they have to say when they're grieving, and then they say all the same thing. So you'll never actually hear another story when they put the microphone in front of somebody who's just witnessed a tragedy. They've watched the earlier incarnations, and they say the same thing. So what I wanted was the ability to say STFU, which I think anybody listening knows what mm-hmm. that means. Shut the bleep up. On a particular topic. In other words, right. no more Virginia Tech news for me, please.
Don't give me any more Boris
No more
Yeltsin
of this,
news.
No more of that. Right. However, if you have any news about Bill Gates, I want that.
Right.
And although it's always turning off. You don't get to ask for stuff in the checkbox news thing. They offer the topics to you,
uh-huh.
and they're all checked by default. And uh-huh. so a new item happens, a new checkbox appears, it's checked because that's just the way they produce the news.
Uh-huh.
But you get to turn it off.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, this turns out to be, if it ever exists, it's a way for the news system to fit itself to what their audience wants to be informed about. So
right.
if everybody has turned off Virginia Tech, then they know that they don't need to produce any more of that because nobody's actually going to be watching it, right? It can turn into a void.
Part of what I love about this idea is just imagining the squeals of protest from news traditionalists. If you
You're
ever,
right. Yeah.
If you ever debuted this
They
system,
wouldn't like it, right?
They, oh, man.
Because they'd say, well, everybody would always want to hear Michael Jackson's stuff.
No, they'd say they'd turn off any news they don't like because it makes it uncomfortable because they don't want to hear reality, see? So everyone would just...
But of course, they're...
It would be another echo chamber, you're living in your cocoon type critique.
I got...
It would
but
take
ta-da,
5 seconds.
I got news for you. That's all they're producing anyway, right? I mean, it's like, yeah.
Well, you can see why I'm chucking. So I like checkbox news as a starting point.
No, but the first thing we have to produce is we have to produce the Twitter for news that isn't owned by Twitter. That is what has to be produced. That is by far the most immediate need. The one where the journalists and the users and the readers get to determine what the maximum number of characters is, not some guy in Silicon Valley who thinks 140 is the magic number, because it's not the magic number.
Mm-hmm.
We know almost for sure that can't possibly be the magic number. Because it was chosen at random.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be better numbers, you know. And then there's all these other features. And there's a lot of capriciousness in the way Twitter is run. And everybody has now seen that. If anybody had a reason to not say that they hadn't seen it, it was the developers. The developers had to be careful because they all wanted to do their deal with Twitter. Now they know they're not going to do the deal with Twitter. So now what's left of their businesses can be applied to the open system.
So yeah. They're liberated.
Well, yeah, we'll see. One of the things I want to see desperately is to see an open source Twitter client, a really high quality open source Twitter client, so that basically when we want to support a new protocol, we don't have to ask one of these cowards to do it. We can just put it in ourselves, you know, because these guys don't ever want to do anything that requires any courage at all, you know. So
as you were drifting across the country,
this is what happened.
From Nebraska to
my fear just evaporated on all this stuff, and I said, "Let's just go for it."
Uh-huh.
I remembered what it was like being 22 years old, you
uh-huh.
know. And at 22 years old, I had no stake whatsoever in
right.
the technology industry. They had not created a place for me, you know. And so I just went in and disrupted the whole thing. That was my attitude. So
mm-hmm.
I turned everything upside down because, you know, I have no stake in this. Well, I want to find some of those 22-year-old guys, or they don't have to be guys, 22-year-old people who are brilliant, who are and irreverent, and let's just go do what we need to do.
Are you aware what the cover of New York Magazine is this week?
No.
It's about a new generation of geeks is coming aboard and
not only are they dreamers, but they're part of what they're dreaming about is how to make New York better. And it's the Foursquare people.
Oh,
it's
okay.
It's the tech world.
I did see that article. I didn't realize it was on the cover of New York, though. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about the emerging tech media scene in New York.
Yeah.
And some of the idealism of the people involved
in
it.
Let's be idealistic. What the hell? You know, what's wrong with that? You know? I'm 22 now, again. Fat chance. Anyway, what's next? David Gregory? Should we talk about David Gregory?
Well, let's talk about Stephen Colbert.
Okay, yeah. I hear you're famous again, Jay.
Wednesday night, I was alerted to this late in the day that there was going to be a segment on the Colbert Report featuring Jake Tapper of ABC News and Bill Adair of PolitiFact.com about their fact-checking the Sunday Show's experiment, which grew from a blog post I had written back in December. And I said, oh, great, I can't wait to watch that to see what Colbert made of this experiment. And then Tapper told me that he actually talks about you and shows your picture. So
you mean you?
Me,
Jay.
Yeah. So I tuned in at 11:30, and sure enough, he starts by saying, you know, I'm a big fan of the Sunday Shows. And then he shows my picture comes up on the screen, my Wikipedia picture photo, and a little shot of my posthumous blog where I talked about my simple fix for the Sunday Shows. And he says, this crazy professor thinks that one way to improve the Sunday Shows would be to institute this fact check. And then he pulls out like an excerpt of the post that has several adjectives in a row, and he says, what Field Marshal Thesaurus here doesn't understand. So that instantly becomes like a moniker that people are using, you know, for me, like Field Marshal Thesaurus.
Yeah, I like that.
And Colbert is, the brilliance of his character is that what he's saying is not really what he's saying. So what he's saying is that this clueless professor thinks that he could improve the Sunday Shows by this fact check. What he was really saying was David Gregory is a clown for not doing this.
Totally.
And he makes fun of David Gregory on the air. So he says, now David Gregory has rejected this harebrained scheme, saying people can fact check Meet the Press every week on their own terms. Thank you, David. It is not a Sunday host's job to make sure his guests aren't lying any more than it's a party host's job to make sure the food isn't poisoned. The host is there to tell his guests when it is their turn to talk. That is why NBC is currently grooming Gregory's replacement at Chess Timer.
What?
A chess timer. So there's a picture of Gregory with a chess clock on
it. Timer.
This is like his only job is to decide how much time you get to talk.
Well, he does that very well.
That's pretty much,
So
that's our critique, right? So it's presented.
Well, he's hair, too. He's got nice hair.
Nice hair. Yeah. Absolutely. He's sculpted well. Yeah. So then Tapper comes out. And Tapper was pretty good, actually. And Bill Adair, PolitiFact, came out. And, you know, lots of people on Twitter are watching this. So that was cool because it meant that this critique had broken into a part of the culture.
It's potentially quite disruptive. I mean, what you're looking for, I guess, is the moment when the guest is aware they're going to be fact-checked and therefore doesn't lie.
Right. So this is here's what we're going to find out.
Or even better, actually, is that certain guests want to be on the show because it's being fact-checked.
Yeah, see, when Russert developed his method of showing people what they had said and then confronting them with what they're saying now, right?
Was bullshit, though.
It wasn't always bullshit.
But his main point was, look, you changed your mind.
Right. Well,
as if that was
some kind of crime. Yeah.
Right. What if somebody actually admitted that they changed their mind? What would Russert have done then? Because everybody argued with him about it. They said, no, I didn't change my mind because blah, blah, blah. What if somebody said, yeah, and so what? I changed my mind. Okay. I never heard anybody say that.
That's true. However, what I was going to say is that Russert developed the reputation, we can argue about how worthy this reputation was, of being the toughest interview, the most difficult to negotiate. But that became an attraction to the Pauls and movers and shakers who were invited on the show, because it meant that you gained extra legitimacy by submitting yourself to the questioner. So anyway, here's the thing that's in doubt about this whole fact-checking thing, is whether David Gregory, by refusing to do this, will get more and better guests, or whether Tapper, by instituting this fact-check, will actually become more attractive to certain guests because they know that they're going to face that afterwards, right?
Yeah.
And we don't know what the answer is. And also whether ABC will have enough courage to stick with it, and whether Gregory will be able to withstand
the
criticism
that he's
getting. Well,
this is up to you, though. In other words, and what you're doing is right. By beating the drum repeatedly on this, you sort of force the issue at the other place. Once you have one person adopting it, now your job gets possible. It gets doable. Whereas before, you were just sort of like a guy off in the wilderness, you know, saying,
yeah,
wouldn't this be
a great idea? Yeah.
But nobody listens to you because they don't have to. Well, at this point, they're beginning to have to. I mean, I had lunch yesterday with Dan Farber, who is the editor-in-chief of CBS.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, you know, Dan, do you know about this? And he didn't know about it. He did not know about it. And I don't think it really clicked for him. But he went on to tell me about how he was having a meeting inside of CBS News to talk about how they needed to embrace the web more. So what that means, I think, is sort of like the thing we were talking about last week with the New York Times reporter that was reporting various sort of milestones in the project as she was going and then culminating with the big story. I think that's sort of the thing he's talking about. But now we could get it on his agenda, probably. If we beat the drum over and over again, we could probably get CBS. Now, you're going to eventually get David Gregory to do this.
Well,
That's the thing is, I don't think he's really thought it through. I think
he hasn't thought it through. No.
And once he does, it's going to obviously. Why wouldn't they want to do this? I don't get it.
Because
they
might
lose some guests.
They might lose some guests, or it's sort of more banal than that. As I wrote in my post this week, maybe he just doesn't want to adopt something that Tapper did first because he's the leader. Here's another possibility, Dave, is I think Gregory will try to be quite stubborn on it and won't actually do it. But another way to go about this is people can fact-check Meet the Press, whether Meet the Press agrees to or not.
Right.
And so really what he's doing is he's inviting it from the outside. And then the challenge becomes to make that outside fact-check as ubiquitous as the show itself, culturally speaking.
It's hard to do, isn't it?
Well, it's hard to get the same television viewing audience that Meet the Press
has. Tapper mentioned this on his show, by the way?
He has.
He has, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's gone on to Colbert to talk about it, too. So obviously this is a big deal for him, right?
Right. Well, Tapper was on Colbert as a guest doing something new, and Gregory was on Colbert as the object of ridicule. That's got to register somewhere in NBC.
Well, yeah, why isn't it on The Daily Show? It should be on The Daily Show, too. It seems like the kind of thing that he would go for, like, immediately, right?
Well, yes. I mean, we'll see. I'm not going to drop it. I mean,
you have to keep beating the drum on this.
Right. Yeah. So the other alternative is that the fact check is done to them from the outside.
Yeah.
That's what he's inviting. There's already a Facebook group, not produced by me, to pressure Meet the Press into adopting the After the Show fact check.
Great.
So that's, you know, a little thing.
Yeah.
But it could grow.
Somebody said to me on Twitter that they wanted it to be real time, but I said that would be brutal and that would be pointless.
This has been said like maybe 59 times.
I know, but it's not the right answer because it's like the back channel, right? It's like, you know, it would be inhumane and it would make the conversation impossible. Right?
You know what's funny about this? When you do a lot of writing, freelance writing, you eventually learn to leave some mistakes and fat into your article so that the editor can take it out. Because if the editor doesn't have something to do, they'll actually go for more radical reconstruction.
Right. Yeah.
So you leave a few things in there and then they can feel like they did their job and most of what you want remains intact, right?
Yeah.
So in floating ideas, I've learned it's the same thing. You have to put some things in there that everybody can correct and sort of jump on. And and that is actually how they participate. So in this idea...
Yeah, that's the thing everybody jumps on.
So in this idea, everybody, the first thing they say is, make it real time. You know, it should be the same day. It should be at the same time, you know? And then I like listening to us. Okay, you know, yeah, that's interesting. But then we can, like, talk about the rest of it. Right?
And you ignore that suggestion completely.
No, I would ignore that because...
That's so funny because I never do that. When I float ideas, I never throw extra crap in there.
Well, just a little tip for you, Dave.
Yeah, maybe I ought to be doing that. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, like, you know, when I talk about let's do a conference, almost the, you know... I do that. I float a lot of ideas about conferences. I just think in those terms, right? And then the knee-jerk is, oh, well, we'll just do that online. I go, no, the whole point is to do it face-to-face.
Right.
You know, I understand exactly. Yeah. So
well,
let's beat the drum. Let's figure out how to make this. This is a very good trend, I think, you know?
Yeah, I don't have a grand strategy. I just keep...
Beat the drum.
Yeah,
just doing it.
Keep working on it. And it has – what I like about this particular idea is that it isn't radical. It's common sense.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the existing values of journalism. What could be more basic to the values of journalism than a fact check, right?
Yeah, totally.
And says, hey, you need to do this because this is you. And so what happens is that those who are pushing the idea can't be isolated from sort of the core of journalism because they are at the core. That's the strategy.
Whatever happened to Scott Rosenberg's project?
That is moving into beta form.
Is it?
Yes.
So you're keeping track
of it? And it is ready for testers. And
that is like an open fact checker, right?
It's a bug catching system for news. Yeah.
Interesting. So how will that play? What kind of role will that play in here?
Good question. I have to look at it.
What's the name of it again?
Media Bugs.
Media Bugs?
The Media Bugs Project. Yeah. Maybe we should have them on the phone or something.
Yeah. Well, once they're ready.
Yeah, once they're ready. Yeah. But it's becoming, you know, a larger thing because it's obvious that there are so many more ways to catch bugs, whatever kind they are, to check facts, to say, hey, wait a minute, is that true? Does it square with what else we've known? And journalism is just sort of behind on this, you know. So that's why these efforts are emerging in different places at the same time, PolitiFact, Media Bugs.
Very good trend.
Right.
It's really good.
The thing that I'm pushing, yeah.
It's quality control. You know, it's, it can be applied anywhere. It doesn't have to just be for professional journalists, it can be for anything.
Totally.
Know? So it's another one of these level the playing field sort of things where.
Yes, and it's unbuilding something that got built into journalism that was very dangerous, which is you say black, this person says white. It would be really hard and really expensive for us to find out who's right, so we'll just go on to the next thing.
Right.
Right? That became routine.
Yeah.
And it's that very
ritual.
Or
it's even worse. They say, well, the answer must be gray because it's like halfway between.
Even more formulaic, correct? Right. That's even dumber in a lot of ways.
Usually it's way dumber. I mean, usually it's wrong.
90 seconds.
And this is what the agony of CNN, this is why I keep beating on CNN, is that CNN thinks...
Right.
That by saying these guys say black and these guys say white and we're right down the middle, that somehow they've solved the problem. Actually, they are just transferring the problem, you know, to the viewers.
Well, they're of the school of David Gregory.
Yeah, totally.
David Gregory would be right at home on CNN.
And I have zero sympathy for both of them.
Right.
And
no.
And there's a
they're
lot of
they're war criminals. They're basically war criminals.
Well, wait a minute.
All right. You think that's too far. I've maybe pushed a little far. But it's the same kind of thing, though. If we're trying to reboot the news, okay, not war criminals, but they're certainly, maybe we ought to have that. Is like we ought to give awards positive, but we also ought to give, you know, awards, negative awards too, for people who are, you know, being, you know, sticks in the mud for the rebooting the news, you know.
Maybe rebooting we need to give them a boot, yeah. In the, you know what.
Oh, we're having too much fun here. This is crazy. How did this happen?
But the reason I'm hitting on CNN is the same thing. It's that these old systems where you don't take responsibility for truth, you simply sort of pass it along,
right?
And that helps the flow of the show, the flow of the program. is not acceptable anymore. And tons of people realize that. Dave, it's been a pleasure. See you next week.
Wow, that was good. Okay, bye.